There were two victims in this case, Jenny Merrill and Emily Byrne. The story of Goat Castle has really been focused on the wild man and the goat woman and the goat castle. But there's another story, and that is the story of racial injustice.
On August 4th, 1932, Jenny Merrill was shot and killed in her Natchez home known as Glen Burnie. This is the mystery of Jenny Merrill's murder and the legendary story of how her murder became known as the Goat Castle Murder of Natchez.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight. And I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right.
Welcome to episode 13 of Southern Mysteries. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. Well, this is the first of four episodes in the Mysteries, Myths, and Legends of Mississippi March Madness series. All four episodes will feature the city of Natchez, Mississippi. Back in 2016, Natchez celebrated the city's 300th birthday, and the tricentennial website of Natchez shared this description of their lovely city. Established by French colonists in 1716, Natchez was one of the oldest and most important European settlements in the lower Mississippi Valley. Named after the Natchez Indians, Natchez spent periods of time under British and Spanish colonial rule before becoming part of the United States with the establishment of the Mississippi Territory in 1798, and later served as the first capital for the new state of Mississippi in 1817. Located high above the mighty Mississippi River, Natchez did not hold a strategic position during the Civil War and was spared much of the damage other cities suffered. As a result, more than 600 examples of antebellum architecture remain, more than any other city in the South. These historic homes and buildings, dozens of African-American heritage sites, along with churches and other historic landmarks, make Natchez a rare find for history buffs. You know, Natchez truly is a city that's a haven for history and architecture lovers and for photographers. Photography is a hobby of mine, and it's what drew me to Natchez for my first visit back in 2014. It's a beautiful city, but it's also a city that's seen its share of mysteries and scandals and interesting characters, like the long-forgotten story of the people whose lives intersected in Natchez when Jenny Merrill was murdered on August 4th of 1932. Now, before we dive into the story, you need to know about the Jim Crow South. It's a term you'll hear as we move forward, and I realize not all of you listening live in the South or even in America. So I want to make sure you understand what that means, because it's important to the Goat Castle murder. Jim Crow laws, as they were known, were established by Southern states in the late 1870s into the early 1880s. And Jim Crow laws legalized segregation between African Americans and whites. They restricted rights of African Americans to use public facilities. That meant that African Americans were barred from using white schools, barred from being able to vote, even to find decent employment. The best way to put it, Jim Crow laws made it legal to exclude African Americans from exercising their rights as Americans. Now, Jim Crow laws were finally abolished in July of 1964. That's when President Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It invoked the Commerce Clause that outlawed discrimination in public accommodations. The Voting Rights Act, it followed in 1965, which gave Black people the right to vote. Legal rights for African Americans were established, but the belief in and the practice of Jim Crow laws would last well into the 1970s here in the South. And those Jim Crow laws led to unimaginable instances of injustice in the South, including the Goat Castle murder. Karen Cox is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and the author of Goat Castle, a true story of murder, race, and the Gothic South. And she joins me today to tell the story of the Goat Castle murder. Our listeners will learn as we chat, Karen, that there's nothing simple about this case. So I would like you, if you would, to set the stage and explain what happened in Natchez in March of 1932 that really put the city on the map and raised this nationwide awareness and interest in Natchez.
Well, it was the first pilgrimage of homes that drew over 3,800 visitors to Natchez. And Natchez at the time was just very a little bit over 13,000 residents. So having 3,800 people show up in town was a shock, but also a welcome surprise because it was, you know, the middle of the Depression, and the Natchez Garden Club had hoped that maybe they could open these homes and it would become a tourist attraction, and indeed that's what happened. Almost immediately, it got national attention. By the second year, by 1933, the New York Times was publishing articles encouraging visitors to go to Natchez and to be sure and give themselves enough time to see all the houses that would be on tour.
And a few months later, in August of 1932, there's a woman named Jenny Merrill who's found murdered in Natchez in her home, or outside of her home. And the story quickly becomes national news because of that interest in Natchez. And the people who were believed to be involved in the murder and associated with Jenny Merrill made news, too. So tell us about Jenny Merrill and this man she was so close to, Duncan Miner.
Right. Jenny Merrill was descended from the upper crust of Natchez, like the most elite of the planter class. And her father was Ayers Merrill, who was a very well-to-do planter. And then also in the years after the war, he became ambassador to Belgium. So she was descended from great wealth in her family. And then there was her second cousin, Duncan Miner, also descended from one of the best families, most elite families in and around Natchez. And, you know, as families like that would have done in the antebellum period, they would have expected their daughters to marry within other well-to-do families. And if it was a second cousin, well, you know, that was fine as well. But this is she's born right in the middle of the Civil War. It changes everything for those families, but they're still close families, and Duncan is smitten with Jenny from the time he was a young man. But she's kind of a woman of the world. She's been to Belgium. She lived a long time in New York, and he's always pining for her because he's still back in Natchez helping his mother run their plantations. Eventually, she will return to Natchez. I've guesstimated it's in the mid to late 1890s. You know, Duncan is there. He's been waiting for this his whole life. And they're not married, at least not that we know of. They remain close. He rides his horse every night to come see her and spend the night. And then he gets up in the early morning, rides back over to his plantation, Oakland. They're just kind of a pair that are together until her death during a botched robbery on August 4th, 1932.
After Jenny Merrill is found, after her body is found and we know she's been murdered, there were two sets of people, I don't want to call them couples, because they weren't married, but they become suspects in this case. First, there was Jenny Merrill's very odd neighbors, Octavia Dockery and Dick Dana. So tell us about Octavia Dockery and Dick Dana and the contentious relationship they had with Jenny Merrill.
Right. They were the neighbors. The neighboring estate was known as Glenwood, and Jenny's is known as Glen Burnie, but Glenwood had been Dick Dana's inheritance. But he is an odd character. He gradually declines mentally until he is declared non compos mentis, meaning, you know, he has a lunacy hearing, and he clearly can't take care of himself. And so he's really also not able to take care of the estate, Glenwood. And he will live with a series of families in town, and someone else is usually paying the taxes on the property. So even though it was his inheritance, he really doesn't own it anymore because of his inability to pay taxes. So he boards with different families, and he ends up boarding with a couple named the Foremans, Richard and Nydia Foreman. And Nydia's younger sister is Octavia Dockery. And at one point, that's when the two of them meet. Eventually, the Foremans and then Dick Dana and Octavia Dockery will will move into Glenwood, and I believe that Foreman probably paid the taxes so they could move onto the estate. And then Mr. Foreman, Nydia dies, and that just leaves Octavia and Dick Dana, and they really have no place to go, and they don't have any money. So they are living on this estate that probably about move in around 1916. And from the get-go, there's a constant feuding, primarily between Jenny Merrill and Octavia Dockery. And the feuds are caused over the fact that the hogs and the goats that Octavia is raising on a little farm there adjacent to the house keep escaping and trespassing onto Jenny Merrill's estate and eating her roses and tearing up the ponds and this, that, and the other. So there's been a feud going on between these two women from the time they became neighbors. And then by 1932, and you have to understand, the sheriff's office has gone out there dozens of times. And about a week before Jenny Merrill died, there was apparently a particularly vicious argument between the two women. And a few days later, she shows up dead. So the sheriff goes to talk to both Dana and Dockery because he figures that they're somehow implicated. At least it's worth a discussion. And Dick Dana comes downstairs when the sheriff arrives at the house and says, "I know nothing of the murder." And he hasn't even, Jenny's Merrill's body had not been found at that point. So he's immediately arrested. And whatever Octavia said, they arrested her and took her into the Adams County Jail. And it turns out that their fingerprints will be found inside of the house.
So the other two important people in this story, when you look at suspects and the whole case, Emily Burns and Lawrence Williams, or George Pearls, as he was known. Tell us about Emily Burns and Lawrence Williams.
Okay, well, there's two African-American suspects. They're kind of paired in my book. There was a guy who came to town from Chicago who called himself Lawrence Williams. He probably was Lawrence Williams. He was raised in Adams County, but when he went to Chicago, he had an alias, and he was named George Pearls. But he comes to Natchez in the summer of 1932 looking for work because it's the Depression. He's lost his job in Chicago, and he's trying to make a little some money. He meets Emily Burns, who is a laundress, who shares a home with her mother. They take in boarders. And within a week of arriving in Natchez, he moves in with the two of them. It seems as though there was an interest between Lawrence, who introduced himself to Emily as Pinkney Williams, so she called him Pink. So he's the same guy. There was sort of a love interest between the two of them. And Pearls had come back looking for work, and he had gone over to Jenny Merrill's estate, and she offered him food, but no job. He went to Duncan Miner's estate, same thing. And then he walked over to Glenwood and knew he wasn't going to get any paid work there because of the condition of the house and the estate. But he struck up a conversation with Dana and Dockery, and they plotted to rob Jenny Merrill. And he goes back that day, ask Emily to go on a walk with him. And as they get closer and closer to Jenny Merrill's estate, they meet up with Dana and Dockery, and then the four of them head over to Merrill's home. Of course, Emily did not want to be a part of this, but Lawrence Williams, Pinkney Williams, who she cared about, threatened to kill her if she left or said anything. So the four of them will be at the house at the same time that night, and Pearls will go in to try to rob Jenny Merrill. I believe she puts up a fight. He ends up shooting her and killing her, and then the body is then taken out of the house and thrown in a thicket about 100 yards from the house. And Dana and Dockery go inside, which is why their fingerprints are found inside. And Emily is told to stay as a watch outside. That's how the four of them are sort of, their paths cross. That's what happens on the night of the murder.
So again, we go back August 4th, 1932. Well, really, it was into the early morning hours of August 5th when Jenny Merrill's body was found, right?
Correct.
So you've got Dockery and Dana that are in jail. The sheriff, Book Roberts, has arrested them. They're in jail. And then while they're in jail, they give jailhouse interviews that went national. So can you share this, just the impact those interviews and the photos that were taken of Dockery and Dana had on their case?
Right. What happens is they give these interviews, and they also have their, like, a portrait of them, you know, made individually and as a couple. And so in those interviews, you learn, you know, you get the sense, you understand why Dick Dana gets the nickname the Wild Man, because his mind is not quite right. But, you know, he tells a story about his life, and, you know, he'll ramble, et cetera. And then Octavia Dockery will craft a narrative of her life as this, like, Southern belle falling on hard times. And basically, it's an attempt to elicit sympathy from the community. But those stories, and then sort of a blending of those stories, along with the idea that Jenny Merrill was a recluse, they put all that together, and it becomes the story that comes out of Natchez. It becomes less about the crime and more about the decline of the planter aristocracy. And so that story and their photograph circulates across the country in papers, you know, from New England to, you know, to the West Coast and across the South. And they become, you know, they achieve a kind of a notoriety because of their affiliation with the murder, but really about how they represent sort of a declining Old South and even a Gothic South.
Goat Woman and Wild Man, as they became known. So you would think, as you said, you've got Dockery's and Dana's fingerprints found in Jenny Merrill's house. So you would think case is closed, but it's not that simple. So tell us what happened to Lawrence Williams, also known as George Pearls or as Pinky, depending on who knew him as which person under what alias, and the shift in the case that happened a few days after Jenny Merrill was found murdered.
What ends up happening is, you know, you have this detective come up from New Orleans named Maurice O'Neill, and he's there to assist the sheriff of Adams County, Book Roberts, and he's, you know, basically pushes the investigation into the black community. And you know, and this would have been typical of the Jim Crow South. If something happened to a white person, it must have been because, you know, some quote-unquote Negro did it. So they round up a lot of black suspects and interview them. That the night of the murder, George Pearls, a.k.a. Lawrence Williams, heads out of town, and he's headed back to Chicago, and he leaves at probably around midnight. But he leaves his trunk of belongings back at Emily's house because he needs to be light on his feet. He needs to get out of there. And so he heads north. 3 days later, he is shot and killed in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, under circumstances completely unrelated to the Merrill murder. And what that means is, so this is going to leave Emily. And somebody essentially in town informs the sheriff that this guy, Williams, was staying with Emily and her mother, Nellie Black. And so the sheriff deputies go to their home, discover the trunk of belongings, and they're immediately arrested. They will stay in the Adams County Jail for 4 months without an attorney. They are never offered an attorney. Whereas Dane and Dockery will have attorneys volunteering their services for their case. And so essentially, you know, she is just gets the shakedown from sheriff's deputies until she finally confesses, which I, you know, put in quote marks because she's kind of, her confession is forced. And Dana and Dockery will be allowed to go home on their own recognizance, and then they will all wait for the grand jury. The grand jury will in November will hand down the indictments, and the only person to be indicted will be George Pearl's Lawrence Williams posthumously, and then Emily Burns as an accomplice to first-degree murder, which, again, she just happened to go on a walk with this guy, and it all went wrong. So she'll be the only one to be tried, and she'll be convicted and then been sent to prison at the state penitentiary. Everyone knows as Parchman.
Before Emily Burns even goes on trial, you've got Octavia Dockery and Dick Dana. Really, you know, they've been set free now. They're out of jail, and they're living up their media celebrity as Goat Woman and Wild Men at their home and even on the road, right?
Yeah. Even as they were sitting in jail, there were hundreds of tourists. That's not a, you know, a hyperbole. There were nearly 1,000 tourists showed up on the Sunday after they were arrested, and were going over the grounds and going in the house and taking souvenirs. So when they got out of jail, under the advice of a group of people called themselves the committee, when we'll never know who they are, you know, went ahead with the idea that they could charge people to enter the grounds. So that was 25 cents, and then they cleaned, and I don't know how clean it was, but they cleared a path inside of the house, and after which they began to charge a second fee just to enter the house. So 25 cents to the grounds, another 25 cents to go inside the house, which during the depths of the Depression was considerable. And Dick Dana would have offer piano concerts in the morning and the afternoon on both Saturday and Sunday. So that was, you know, them inviting tourists in to make money on their notoriety. And then someone helped set up a tour for them to go to places in Mississippi and Louisiana. And Dick Dana got cleaned up and got a new suit. But they would go on tour and actually be introduced to the crowd as the Wild Man and the Goat Woman of Goat Castle. You know, the house, which is something we haven't talked about, but the house gets its own nickname as Goat Castle because they keep a pen of goats inside what had been the formal dining room of this once really nice house.
It is so frustrating to hear what they did and the celebrity they attained. While you've got Emily Burns, who had undergone just intense questioning, she had, you know, as you put it, and I want to put it too, quote unquote, confessed to a role in the murder, and then she goes on trial, she's convicted, and ends up in prison. It's injustice.
It definitely is. I mean, I see this as there were two victims in this case, Jenny Merrill and Emily Burns. The story of Goat Castle, as it's long been remembered and repeated over time in Natchez, has really been focused on the, you know, the Wild Man and the Goat Woman and the Goat Castle, but there's another story, and that is the story of racial injustice. And that's really what my book, you know, I think contributes to understanding the case.
I feel like the truth of Emily's story basically could have been lost if you didn't seek it out and make sure to tell it in your book. Because when I've heard of the Goat Castle murder, I've never understood the full story before of what happened to Emily and how you said, I mean, she really was also a victim here, which is why I'm so glad that you invested so much of your life and your time to tell her story too, to bring it to light. Tell us about the decision that the governor of Mississippi did make in 1940 that affected Emily Burns.
The governors of Mississippi starting in 1932 offered what were called mercy courts. And that would be when the governor would go to Parchman, and he would look at petitions from local citizens about an individual who was imprisoned at Parchman, and he would decide if he was going to grant him mercy, which would either be a pardon or a suspended sentence. Emily had tried, I think, for the first couple of governors, for the one that actually granted her a suspension, but she went before Paul B. Johnson, Sr. in 1940, and he believed her, and he believed that she was innocent, that she was, you know, caught in a situation beyond her control. And he had a petition from citizens in Natchez, but it was the one document, if I could have found it, it would have been really, really meaningful, but I was never able to locate it. But he suspended her sentence. In other words, he just said, okay, that's it. You know, you're 8 years, and as long as you don't do anything, you don't have to come back. It's almost like a pardon. And so she goes, you know, before his mercy court in December 1940. At this point, she's been at Parchman 8 years, which was a hell hole in the 1930s. And he believes her, and he grants her suspension, and she's able to return to Natchez and live out the rest of her life, resume, you know, a place in her church, which is Antioch Baptist Church on Liberty Road outside of Natchez. And she will live until September of 1969.
In researching your book, you did, of course, travel to Natchez, and you met the family of Emily Burns. So tell us about that meeting and what you learned about Emily through the eyes of her family.
I went down there. You know, Emily was a widow when she went in to prison, and she eventually would remarry after childbearing age. So she didn't have children. And so what I did know was, from talking to some people who recalled knowing her, was that she went to this church, and that family members, extended family members, also went to the church. So I went to church. I went into the church not knowing what I would find, and I ended up meeting second cousins. There were four sisters, and I learned there was another one, but there was four sisters who had, when they were young girls, had taken turns caring for Emily in her old age, you know. And so I met them, and then I was invited the following day to one of the sisters' homes, and that's where I was able to finally see a photograph of Emily, because I had no idea what she looked like. And it was a meaningful meeting for me, because I was able to really see her in context of a family and get to know her a little bit better. You know, the photograph was really key. They were such young girls, they didn't remember her a lot, you know, other than having to take care of her, you know. And kids remember, you know, what they remember from their childhood is kind of different than if they had known her as an adult. And I learned that she went by the name Sister, not because she had sisters, but that was just her nickname. And people who knew her, like, called her Sister, and they were her second cousins, and they called her Cousin Sister. So that was, like, personalized her. It humanized her. And the fact that the photograph I found that I was able to use for the book was provided by the family was so much better than a mugshot, because, you know, she really wasn't a criminal. She was really just a normal woman living her life, you know, when things just went haywire, and she had never done anything that would have suggested she was a criminal. Anyway, that was really, really important to helping me understand what had happened to her. And also, just certain things that would be mentioned in the paper. For example, the Natchez Democrat would say, oh, a Negro preacher by the name of Charles Anderson came to visit Emily. Well, I didn't know what that meant until I'd gone to visit Antioch and realized, he had been a minister there at that church. Then it all came together. I was like, oh, this had been her church all along, and this was her minister coming to see her.
And her support.
Yeah. So that was he was the only person, only visitor that Emily and her mother were allowed to see while they were in jail at the Adams County jail for 4 months.
So what kind of response have you gotten from Natchez about the book, and especially bringing to light the injustice of what happened to Emily? Because I've, you know, as I said, I've heard the story before, but never understood the injustice.
Well, I tell you, it was just only this past weekend when I really understood what it meant.
Right, because as we're talking, you have just come home from a visit to Natchez. That's right.
I gave a presentation, and afterward, you know, rather than getting questions, I had people would raise their hand and thank me. And one of them was a woman who is one of the tour guides. I guess they're certified there or something like that. So she said she wanted to thank me. She said, because now we can tell the full story of this crime and this case. I had several people come up to me personally afterward, again, thanking me, again, saying, you know, they were, you know, appreciative of the research that went into it. We're thankful, you know, that they're, you know, that to have their eyes open to the full story and this story of racial injustice. Bertia Green, who is one of the second cousins who helped me along the way, you know, made the introductions, you know, made it possible for me to get this photograph. She was there. I introduced her, you know, to the crowd, which was mostly white. And afterward, she was surrounded by people wanting to asking her questions. So it's been a really good thing, I think, for the community, you know, the people who have bought the book and feel like they've learned new things about the case. And my general feeling is that it's been a positive thing. It's positively received in Natchez.
I'd like to say a special thanks to Karen Cox for sharing the story of the Goat Castle murder with us. And if you want to know more about all the people you've learned about in this episode and really dive into the Goat Castle case, you should read Karen Cox's book, Goat Castle, A True Story of Murder, Race, and the Gothic South. You'll find a link to the book and Karen's website in our show notes, and you can follow her on Twitter. She's at Sassy Prof. Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can see photos of the people mentioned in this episode and their homes in Natchez when you connect with Southern Mysteries on social media. We're on Twitter at Mysteries Pod, or you can find us on Facebook and join our discussion group. Just search Southern Mysteries Podcast. On the next episode of Southern Mysteries, we continue our Mysteries, Myths, and Legends of Mississippi series with a visit to one of the most beautiful and haunting cemeteries in the South, the Natchez City Cemetery.